Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Very happy to be joined by a return guest here almost exactly a year ago, as it turns out. Bayless Wagner, political reporter for the Austin American-Statesman and the San Antonio Express News, and I guess more broadly, like the Hearst Papers. Is that right, Bayless?
Yes. My stories now run in the Dallas Morning News as of a couple weeks ago as well.
Yeah, I may want to talk about that a little bit. Either way, thanks for coming back.
Really happy to be here.
It's great to see you again. I was looking back and I was trying to figure out when it was, and it was really, I think the publication date for the podcast was May 1st during the session. So a kind of, you know, pretty insane at the time. So almost exactly a year. Wanted to have you on back because, you know, you've had some scoops on the Texas side of an ongoing story that, you know, has loomed pretty large in national politics. And that's the sexual misconduct scandals around Republican Texas Congressman Tony Gonzalez and Democratic and you know, by sort of extension, Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell in the last week, 10 days. And so I kind of want to catch up with you on that story, but I also want to talk about your reporting. So before we get to the latest updates, state of play, let's go back and talk a little bit about how this all unfolded. You broke a couple of the big stories, at least one of them, some in collaboration with your colleague, Nancy Prayer Johnson. Give us a little of how difficult it was to nail down this story because it was percolating kind of outside of the mainstream press for a while. And I kind of want to talk about that. So just give us a little of the TikTok of how you covered the story and how you confirmed it and were able to kind of bring it to the public.
Yeah, this is an interesting case where I think, the sort of political outside of the mainstream press and the mainstream really work together in a way. I'm friends with Tony Ortiz, who has this publication called Current Revolt. It's a right of center, you know, conservative online sort of blog. And he published the first story pointing to rumors that Representative Gonzalez had an affair with this staffer, Regina Santos Aviles, who died by suicide. And these reports were fairly, they were just, you know, you heard about this staffer who, while still employed for a congressman, set herself on fire outside of her home. And it just, I think people were just like, what happened there? And then he kind of immediately came out with this story. Like, there are rumors that they slept together, but no proof. It was just sort of like, this is alleged. And Gonzalez was able to sort of just shake it off. He didn't answer any questions from the press about it for a very long time. The first time I was able to ask him directly about it, because I contacted his office and asked many times, but I didn't get a response. The first time I was able to ask him directly was at the Texas Tribune Festival in November.
I was just going to say, this is kind of unfolding in the fall of 2025.
Yeah, I should have noted
late
that.
Late summer,
yeah.
Early
so,
fall.
So Santos Aviles died in September 2025. Yes. And November, he has a panel he obviously agreed to months earlier. Right. With Punchbowl News, where he's being interviewed just about sort of what he was predicting for the next year. And Punchbowl, his name is Andrew Desiderio. He asks, you know, oh, there are rumors about your relationship with this staffer who died. You know, I want to give you the chance to address them. He doesn't really name the rumors. Gonzalez says the rumors are completely false. People are saying I've been doing nasty things. I get that. I'm in public office. They're throwing rocks. But he categorically denies all of the rumors. And I ran after him when he left this panel because he was booking it toward the door when it ended. And I was like ready. And I said, Representative Gonzalez, like, what rumors? Can you specify what rumors you are saying aren't true? And he said, all of them. All of them, contact my office. All of them. But he never actually said, I did not sleep with her. He never said I didn't have a relationship with her. So that was kind of, but he was very calm as he said it. And I was like, he's either a very good liar or he's telling the truth. I didn't know at that point. We didn't have proof. But I kept sort of looking into it in the background. In San Antonio, Nancy had been working on sort of the police records about this woman's death, and she had been reporting on that. And from the bureau, I had just been trying to see who I could get on the political side, what staffers, what people might know about this in the, because, you know, the idea was that it was known, obviously. If it was published in one place, it was known. And I wasn't able to get that confirmation until mid-February, when I connected with a staffer who had worked with Regina in the Uvalde district office of the congressman. And he said he had been hesitant because he was still employed for Gonzalez until January. And then he quit and moved to California and started a different job and realized, I'm going to be okay if he knows that I was, because there was no way that Gonzalez wouldn't know who had leaked these messages. There's only one other staffer in the office with Regina at the time that all of this was going down. So I spoke with him, and he shared text messages in which she had texted him before she died saying, I had an affair with our boss. We published that. And that was, and also Nancy then, once I got that, she was able to get the husband's lawyer. So Regina was married with a young kid. And also we should note the congressman is married with 6 kids. And her husband had been sort of, he had not wanted to put anything out in the public yet. But once we had that from the staffer, Nancy was able to get the lawyer to confirm, yeah, we know about an affair. So we went forward with that story. Then once that happened, it seemed like the husband realized, you know, it's going to be out. And he released to us and some other outlets text messages between Regina and the congressman, in which the exchange, I think, is just, that was what kind of blew up and prompted a bunch of Republican lawmakers in the U.S. House to say this guy needs to either step down or drop out of his reelection race. They show that he said at like 10 p.m. one night, can you send me a sexy pic, to his employee. She says, you don't really want to see a picture of me. It was a long day. She's really trying to push him off. And he says, yes, I do. She says, is this a test? I mean, she can't believe it because it's so out of the norm. And he kind of continues pushing, and she says, you're going too far, boss, 2 different times. So anyway, those texts that Nancy got were just, you know, indisputable proof, along with the staffer having told me that they met up twice in a cabin and, you know. So he continues to call it just sort of, he doesn't really directly address it. He calls it, you know, made up by Brandon Herrera, his GOP primary opponent, and then pretty soon after he gets second place in the primary, he admits to the affair. Because the outcry about it, like from his colleagues, from people in the media,
It wasn't going away.
Yeah. And Speaker Johnson had said he needs to address it with his constituents. So he does. It turns out that maybe that was, I don't know. It seemed like it really frustrated his colleagues, because he had told them, according to CNN, he had told the House Republican campaign arm back in the fall, this isn't true, and it's not going to hurt me. And they had backed him financially.
Yeah.
And they had not put up another candidate who had his, you know, profile.
Yeah, we have to remember the backdrop. You know, the backdrop here, very closely divided delegation in the House. You know, it's been the ongoing narrative of, you know, this legislative session at the national level, and also, you know, a lot of attention to how competitive it was going to be in Texas, and Republicans not losing seats and actually taking advantage of redistricting to potentially gain seats, you know, after the very controversial redistricting in the 25 session.
Yeah, but we were at a point when this came out, that it was the primary race, but also just in Congress, Republicans couldn't really afford to lose one vote, or else Thomas Massie would control the Republican Party, I think was the idea.
And I think I kind of raise that context, because if you go back to Republicans in Congress, in the U.S. House, believing him or being willing to believe him, you know, some motivated reasoning there, given what was going on even before the primaries were in their full public phase, I think.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. But it's interesting because there were other San Antonio Republicans who were interested in running and who maybe could have and could have won. I've been able to confirm finally after.
And people had doubts about Brandon Herrera.
Yeah, he's a particular, we can get into him later if you want. Yeah. But anyway, so he admits to the affair. He calls it a lapse in judgment. He calls it a mistake in a video with a conservative talk show host, Joe Pags. He also says, I asked God to forgive me and he has, which is like a line for the ages. If you ever do anything wrong, just let them know. You know, God has told you he's forgiven you. So then House Republican leadership calls on him to drop out of his reelection bid. He does. But then it seems like he's going to slip under the radar. They're not calling for him to resign because, and Troy Nell said this, we need the numbers. We don't want him to resign. Then Eric Swalwell becomes the story. Well, I guess first, about a month after everything happened. And let me know if I'm going into too much detail. Yeah. But
so he drops out of the primary.
He drops out of the primary, but it looks like no one's really putting pressure on him to resign. Even Democrats were fairly quiet about it, actually, which was sort of interesting to me. Then I get in touch with another staffer who had worked on his 2020 campaign before he was elected, his first campaign. And she has these texts that are, I think we described them as lewd. There were some awkward meetings in the newsroom where I was trying to tell my editors what I had found.
Yes.
I don't really want to describe this.
Lewd is actually kind of tame.
Yeah.
Right.
But they showed that he was actively pursuing a sexual relationship with someone who worked under him, a woman, and asking her over and over and over and over for nude photos, even after she said no. There was just something a little off. She acknowledged she flirted back. So we weren't, she wasn't accusing him of sexual assault or harassment. So that's something to note. But it was very obvious that this was something that had gone on for years, because this was back in 2020.
Right. It obviously casts a lot of doubt on the people who are just throwing rocks explanation that he relied on initially.
And of course, there are rumors about other things that went on. So we published that, and that also became a national story, which I didn't necessarily expect. And then days later, the San Francisco Chronicle, also a Hearst newspaper, publishes the story with the woman who accused Representative Eric Swalwell, a Democrat, of raping her twice when she was too intoxicated to consent.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, this kind of, it's interesting. You mentioned the Swalwell story dropping. You mentioned, Democrats seeming to not make much of this other story. I'm not drawing a direct line there, but it does raise the question that has recurred numerous times about, the culture of male behavior in politics, in Congress, and, something that's come up here a lot as well, obviously, in the last couple of years in the Texas legislature, where you've spent a lot of time and, have not reported in this way, but this would be a good time to have video, because the look on your face as you kind of nodded suggests you're not, you're not shocked by that, shall we say. So give us a sense of where this is now, like where we stand today. CD23 now, that race looks different.
Yeah, immediately after Swalwell was, these reports came out about Swalwell in the Chronicle and CNN. And it really, I think, starts with Ana Paulina Luna, the Florida representative, who says, I'm going to put a motion to expel him. The Democrats, smart move on their part, say, well, if he goes, Gonzalez goes. And then over the weekend, we're just sort of watching like, whoa, whoa, whoa. This guy seemed like he was going to escape. And now that it's one Dem, one Republican, all these Republicans are coming out and saying, well, this behavior is unacceptable. And it's past time for these guys to go.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting after they had not said anything. But I understand the political dynamics 100%.
Yeah, it's kind of a, ethics log rolling in a way, in terms of the one for one thing. Okay, as long as it's not going to affect the balance of power.
Yeah. And Speaker Johnson, to his credit, didn't change his perspective on it.
Yeah.
He kept saying, or at least he didn't come out and say, He has to go. It was really the members, two women, Ana Paulina Luna, and then a Democrat, Teresa Leger Fernandez, or I'm not sure. I pronounce it the French way. I'm not sure if it's supposed to be pronounced that way. But she says she'll put forward the motion to expel Gonzalez. A lot of people, it's a bipartisan push. You know, people get on board over the weekend, and by Monday, it's clear these motions are going to go forward, and they could very well succeed if they. It seems that, I mean, Gonzalez and Swalwell must have known that there was a very serious threat because Gonzalez had been so, so reticent to resign or even sort of give any hint that he would.
Resistant even.
Yeah, so I think it's obvious his hand was forced. I don't think that it was a change of heart. Yeah. The timing is too...
I think that's a fair conclusion.
So, so then by Monday night, Swalwell says he's going to resign that evening, and then an hour and five minutes later, Gonzalez says, I'm stepping down. And so, and then we can...
So are there still threads of the story you're following? Yes. Or you, I mean, we were talking before we went on, went on microphone, that you were still kind of chasing this down. So this is still kind of unfolding.
The question that I'm getting...
Without, exposing you to the competition,
Now, the question I'm getting is, when is this... So now that the seat is empty, okay, we have one Democrat gone, one Republican gone, so the partisan balance of the House remains the same. But there's once... So California Governor Gavin Newsom already set a special election for Swalwell's very, very safe Democratic seat for August 21st, I believe. And that may put pressure on Governor Abbott to set a special election, try to get a Republican, to counterbalance that. But the dynamics are complicated because Gonzalez's seat is not as safe as Swalwell's. It's an R+7. Swalwell's is a D+19.
Yeah.
And the risk of when Democrats have done very well in special elections this year, it's a majority Hispanic seat, and Republicans know they've been losing support among Hispanic voters. That could mean that it's best just not to have a special election in this seat. So that's the next question I'm watching and sort of kind of keeping an ear to the ground about the maneuvering there.
Yeah, you hearing anything?
No. Even the candidates, I don't think they've heard anything from what they've told me. So,
right.
So far, Abbott usually in the past has set special elections within 2 weeks. So I think we'll know within 2 weeks. It can't be on the same day as the primary runoff on May 26th is what I found out yesterday. So that's the next question.
We should say, with the exception of the Democratic seat that they held off on for as long as they possibly could. Yeah.
Did they set that on the same day as the primary?
No. I mean, I'm sorry, to your previous point about the governor usually acts pretty quickly.
True. He waited a month to set the date there. But yes, he delayed it for 8 months and they were without representation for almost a year. The last time a Republican seat opened on an election year, he set a special election for 2 months later.
Okay.
So.
Interesting benchmark.
Yes.
A pair of benchmarks.
We'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens there. And there's also just the question that I'm interested in. The question that I'm interested in is how this was covered up for so long. I would like to know more about the discussions that went on in the fall, but we'll see if I can get that.
Okay. That's it. So I want to move sideways, not even so much backtrack a little bit in terms of the chronology. I'm interested in your comment that this was something in which the current revolt, Tony Ortiz, the non-mainstream press, and for most people who are listening to this are going to be at least a little familiar with the current revolt. But it's it started as kind of anonymous. Like when it was first current revolt, I mean, it was a semi-secret who the person behind it was, 18 months, a couple years ago now, maybe. But tell me more a little bit about how you think about that, because it seems to me that's an interesting dynamic in which, and I've talked about it of other people on the podcast before, where you've got one sector of mostly digital media that has a lower reporting threshold than you're going to have at a more traditional established outlet, whatever that means these days. But there's still kind of a noticeable difference there where you can't, go to your editor and go, hey, I'm hearing rumors, and report, hey, we're hearing this, but it's just rumors. Talk to me about, and yet you said Tony Ortiz, you know, you have a friendly relationship with Tony Ortiz. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, not the relationship per se, but I mean, just, you know, how that works, how the two interact, you know, and, you know, just how that unfolds and how you manage that.
Yeah, I think in this case, I mean, I'll be transparent. I learned about the rumors through the Current Revolt thing. I don't know whether I would have, I think eventually, yeah, I probably would have found it out, but not as soon as I did. It's hard to tell. I think absolutely Gonzalez would not have faced the pressure and the questions over it as early as he did without that report from them. I think there's a role that they play, and what Tony Ortiz does is kind of a nod. It's hard to explain. I think that I mean, as a reporter, I'm not going to sit here and say, tabloid-y outlets shouldn't exist. Like they're beneath me
and I don't pay attention.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think it's, you know, I often learn things from what he posts because he has his finger on the pulse and his ear to the ground. And part of why is because he's got a partisan bent. And so he has more trust from people that share his political ideology. I think that what I do as someone who is, you know, my main goal is to be fair and nonpartisan is very important too. That's why I went into this field. I did not, sometimes people, you know, ask, oh, why didn't you go into politics? I never wanted to go into politics. And I think that the fact that we don't publish rumors was equally important in, you know, this coming out, because when we publish something, people knew it was accurate because we do not publish rumors and we had the receipts. And it was the receipts, as in the text messages, that forced Gonzalez's hand. So I think I respect what Tony does, and I think he plays a role in sort of policing the Republican Party, because Brian Slayton, he had a role in that being discovered.
Right.
The state representative who slept with an underage intern after getting her drunk and was subsequently expelled from the Texas House. So, yeah, I don't think we should discount those kinds of outlets, I guess, is what I would say. But I do think people need to realize that there's a role for both of them. And so when I hear people say, oh, the mainstream media is too liberal or they're biased in some way. No, we have really high standards for evidence. And you can look at it every different way. And I often talk to sources about, well, what are your concerns with the media? And like, you know, let's talk through that. But there's a role that we play that I think is important.
Because my job is different than yours, but in my interactions with people in the political community where I have a lot of friends and personal relationships, and I talk to those people a lot, and in terms of how I sort of ingest information, I always have really sort of mixed feelings about those things. Because on one hand, like everyone else, it's like, you know, more information, better.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say that the Current Revolt brand has been, there's a lot of their stories tend to have a salacious side to them. You know, I mean, the things they're policing, and I'm sometimes a little wary about that. So some of the people I talk to in the community, they read something on that and, you know, like that and say, hey, did you see the Current Revolt thing about X? And I'm like, well, I saw it, but I feel a little odd talking about it.
It's heavily spun. A lot of it is heavily spun.
There's a certain, the status of truth and, you know, just how reliable it is and whether.
Well, and that's, yeah. And
you
that's,
know, you, you know, you could, you know, you can start evaluating people's track records and whatever, but there's also no penalty for being wrong. Put it this way. There's no penalty for being wrong in something like that, like there is in the more structured journalism business.
Yeah.
Where if you get that wrong, you know, you get punished for it.
Yeah, and that's why we have a little bit more trust, you know, is because we were careful not to put stuff out there. But
it's a broader internet problem to some degree, a broader, you know, more democratized, you know, crappy sense of that word. But, you know, information flows that have emerged through social media, internet, et cetera, particularly social media. makes that all more challenging. It puts more responsibility on the consumer. And I guess the bottom line is, and this sounds terrible being an academic, is, you know, I worry that the consumers are not discerning enough.
Mm. I think that that's very fair. And this has been a problem throughout my career. I started my career as a fact check reporter, checking social media misinformation, writing stories like, no, the COVID vaccine won't give you HIV. And it was just so rampant. And people, there's something that conveys officialness, especially when there was a lot of people with the blue check mark on Twitter who'd be spreading flat out lies. So that was a problem. When it comes to something like Current Revolt, I guess what I was going to say, I thought it was interesting that it was also on the Democratic side, social media from partisan influencers that led journalists to get the story. At least they brought it to, I mean, obviously all many political stories come from a political source.
Right.
And so that's what the journalist does, is filters the information to find what is true here.
Right.
So the Swalwell rumors, Politico had a great sort of TikTok story about how this group of influencers sort of collected all these women through social media that they had talked to, and then eventually passed it to a journalist who they knew had the institutional support, as in lawyers, as in, you know, backing if they were sued, and ways to check things that they didn't have.
Yeah.
So.
And I don't want to come off as, you know, censorious or, wanting to put the genie back in the bottle. But I guess what I'm trying to bring out is the fact that it creates real challenges in a way that we're not going to be able to go back on this. And in terms of the way that the only semi-public part of politics works, it's kind of an oppo researcher's dream to have the threshold lower for releasing negative information that, you know, may or may not be true. You know, ideally, I mean, no oppo researcher wants to release something that's untrue and then have it, because then it's ineffectual.
It may not. I mean, that is a problem. It absolutely can be effectual. I mean, there's so many lies in political ads.
Yeah.
So yes, the social media that absolutely foments.
Yeah. I guess it accentuates a problem. It's always been difficult in politics, but it makes it more difficult, I think, and puts a bigger burden on professional reporters. Put it that way.
Yeah.
All right. So we've talked a lot about that. What else is interesting you right now? Or are you just so absorbed with this story? But there's a lot going on. I mean, I think things at the state level, most of it's not been as prominent. You know, we were talking about how last time you were here, we were in the depths of the essence of kind of inside baseball, because we were in May of a session year and, you know, we're watching procedural back and forth and what's going on behind the scene. I'm just wondering what else you're interested in right now.
I'm interested in how this moment is going to continue, because I think it started this whole debate about sexual misconduct coming from, you know, elected officials, and, you know, what is the culture of silence or covering it up. I think that's interesting. I think it's also prompted me to reflect on how our standards for acceptable behavior and language have changed since 2016, for example. There's, you know, a candidate, Bobby Pulido, who is a former Tejano singer, and he's been, you know, the subject of a lot of attacks from his opponent, Monica de la Cruz, Republican, for stuff he said in the past. But it's interesting because the comments, when it's not tied to some kind of behavior, it seems like people are much less likely to care. And I'm kind of interested in what the average voter thinks. Do they still care? Or do they say, well, I mean, Donald Trump has been like Teflon. He's survived all sorts of things that maybe 20 years ago would have knocked a politician out. And so you have to wonder. I think that's an interesting question. I think there's just the question of how the Democrats are going to try and are trying to redirect after what they considered, and I think was widely considered, a disastrous 2024.
Yeah.
How the Republicans are shaping up the new post-Donald Trump version of the party. How the majority, I think how redistricting is going to play out is very interesting in Texas. What else am I following? Those are a few things.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot we could pick up on there, but I don't want to keep you here all morning. I also want to ask what you're doing next. I mean, so you've got this fellowship with the New York Times. Tell us a little bit about that, and you know, how long are you going to be gone? Does this mean you're not going to be here for the session?
Yeah. Well, so. So, yes. So
I'm not sure exactly how to interpret that response.
Well, yeah, that is a hilarious thing. Who would have known? The session, I think another reporter had sort of said this to me, and I so agree. When you're in the session, there comes a point where it's exciting. And then after a while, you're like, oof, get me out of this. This is way too much. I mean, the 4 a.m. nights and the, you know, like just really fast stories. And then after a while you miss it and you're like, it was really cool to be on the House floor, being able to talk with lawmakers about what they were doing. I mean, we are so lucky as reporters.
At least on the House side.
At least on the House side, not in the Senate side. I mean, I think it's like it should be the case in every legislative body that reporters have that kind of access, but you know, I appreciate it. And but I'm excited to be, I'll be an early career fellow at the New York Times starting in June on the national politics team based in New York City. So I'll be covering a lot of this, some of the same things, House campaigns, Senate campaigns, campaign finance, donors. That's sort of their domain besides other political trends, you know, where are voters going, that kind of thing. So hopefully I'll get to travel and see some new, you know, I'll be covering politics outside of Texas for the first time effectively. And that'll be interesting. I'll see how the New York Times does things and how different it is or isn't from how I've been doing them here in Texas. And yeah, but it's a year long and I haven't written off the possibility of coming back to Texas. I'm not sure what's going to happen afterward.
So do you do this fellowship, what happens to your job here? Do you have to give it up?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is sad. I really love my job here.
Well, that's sad for us. You'll be based in New York, in the New York Times newsroom. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Now, between now and the time you leave, you've also been using one of the tools in your toolbox that I don't always associate with you, which is your kind of data journalism chops. And you've been doing a feature for the Chronicle's Chronicle/Hearst, the Texas Take mailer that is mainly a Jeremy Wallace's mm-hmm. thing. So talk a little about what you're doing with that. And you had something interesting this week. Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, my editors proposed that. So Jeremy Wallace is a busy man. He does a podcast as well. And they said, well, how about, you know, one day a week we do a data edition of this political newsletter. And that's been really interesting for me because I minored in computer science in college. Data journalism is something I've been interested in and have worked on throughout my career. And it has prompted me to look at political stories with much more of a lens for money and numbers. So because that's kind of the main data points. I mean, voter statistics, that kind of stuff. So this week, for example, I wrote about James Tallarico raised $27 million in 3 months. What, like, how do you make sense of that number? What is it? What's the comparison? So I looked at, you know, what Senate candidates in other states reported, and he doubled effectively the contender for the second most highest amount raised in one quarter. And the record for most raised in one quarter for a Senate candidate is something like $50 million or something like that from 2020, but that was in the third quarter. And so basically he's on track to be potentially the most prolific fundraiser of any Senate candidate, if he continues, So that was like one thing. I've written about how much money Texans for Lawsuit Reform has pumped into a single House race in San Antonio and how, you know, there was also a larger trend of, you know, tort reform issues driving a lot of spending in different House Republican primaries. And, you know, this battle between the trial lawyers and the tort reform groups. So those are some of the stories I've gotten to look at.
So I'm curious, what do you make of the Tallarico figure? Because it's a, you know, it's a headline all over the place, New York Times headline, in addition to everything around the state. But I got to say, you know, a big part of that had to do with the surge to win the primary. And it's not like he spent it all. But he doesn't have that, you know, I think you look at that and you think, oh, he's going to take that $27 million and you're waiting to spend that money on the general election, whoever emerges. But a lot of that was spent in a very necessary, turned out to be effective way to help him overcome his initial disadvantage vis-a-vis Jasmine Crockett. So, you kind of said, we'll see, does he continue? I think that is the big question.
Yeah, and do those donors that he went to the first go-around want to keep giving when the Republicans have held... He's running to be the first Democratic senator in Texas since 1988.
Yeah.
So, yes, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. And the cash on hand is a big... It's a big number to look at. I don't actually remember how much cash on hand he has.
I think it's about... It's 8 or 9, I think.
8 or 9 million, okay. And so it'll, yeah. And then once the Republicans are going to start donating much more to the nominee once the runoff is over, and then it's a whole different ballgame as well. But the one thing I do think it points to is that he could very likely force Republicans to spend more resources in Texas than they really wanted to, because Texas, right, they've considered it safe, and they may still consider it, they do still say it's relatively safe, but, if they have to blanket the airwaves with ads to compete with Tallarico, that's going to take away.
Yeah. I mean, I think and I can't remember, I was probably Cook for Political Report or something like that. I mean, I think, maybe Sabato, one of those, I think the sense is if Cornyn wins, and I'm not convinced this is entirely right, but if Cornyn emerges from the primary, which I think is looking less likely than it did a while ago, or right after the primary, then it's a, safe Republican. They're going to, they're speculating about moving it to lean Republican should Paxton emerge. But I think that, you sort of flag, there's a positive spin and a less positive spin on those Tallarico numbers, which is, you kind of refer to the less positive spin out there that, if he continues to, in a sense, hoover up this much money, that's money, in a cause that is still pretty questionable. No matter how much enthusiasm you have about Tallarico, this is still the Republicans to lose.
Yes.
To oversimplify the case. But, if it's a leading indicator of, it's the same question we're asking right now that it's really, I think, too early to really answer, which is how high is the Democratic wave? How strong is the Republican seawall against that wave? And how adaptive can Republicans be? I mean, I think, one of the less obvious lessons of 2018 and Better O'Rourke's coming within less than 3 points of Ted Cruz was that when Democrats seem to build momentum and resources and get the alignment of resources, environment, candidate that helps, that increases their chances and gives them something akin to momentum, Republicans have the institutional financial candidate resources to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on a panel with two prominent Republican pollsters at TPPF, at the TPPF confab recently, last week, I guess. And I think there is a real sense that Texas Republicans realize that there's going to be a challenge. I think the discussion there was a little bit, the magnitude of that challenge to my mind was a little bit muted for that audience. But I think there's a real awareness among the campaigns, and particularly among Governor Abbott's campaign team, that they're going to have to be on this, and they're going to have to, people are going to have to spend the money. They need to get started, and they need to not take anything for granted. And when you have such a resource advantage up and down the ballot, that's helpful. I still think it's going to be a relatively good Democratic year. But I think, a statewide still looks pretty challenging to me.
Definitely.
And that lurks over this coverage of the Tallarico number. I mean, there's a lot of enthusiasm. And this is all credit due to Tallarico and his campaign team. They've sustained a lot of interest in their campaign that's helping their positive media coverage, and it's helping their fundraising, I think. And I think from the point of view of reporting on that, that's a big challenge to kind of cover the, where the story is, the ultimate takeaway of the stories on the Tallarico campaigns right now are kind of, well, maybe. And I think that's challenging for y'all. Does that seem to make sense?
Yeah, I try to...
Especially when you're covering money.
I think, yes. I think the headlines to the uninitiated can just make it seem like Tallarico is going to cruise to a win if you live in D.C. and you're not familiar. So when people from D.C. ask me about, friends or... Because people have heard about him all over the country. They donate to him from all over the country. I try to explain the history and the context that makes it such that one needs to consider that Texas has a lot of Republican voters. It has a lot of Democratic voters, more than people think, but I always find it kind of interesting because Texas has this big push to be Democratic for national sort of enthusiasm for, but you never hear about that in California. There's not even like a whisper of like, it's just like, okay, California is super, it's very, very blue and that's the case. So it's sort of interesting. And I do think that it's very possible that nationally Democrats are going to really want to focus their energy on states that are more winnable. I mean, from a probability standpoint.
Well, and I think, actually the Swalwell situation is rattling Californians, I think, the sense of the California race.
True, with the governor, absolutely.
At least at the governor's race.
Yeah.
There are people that still remember kind of the Schwarzenegger thing and, that you can feel like you have things really in hand and then all of a sudden you don't. So it's difficult. Well, I appreciate you being here. Congratulations on the New York Times thing.
Thank you.
We will miss you in the media universe here, but, hopefully you will find your way back for either a story or another gig. So thanks again for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
With that, thanks again, as always. In addition to thanks to Bayless, thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio here in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. If you found this podcast on one of the platforms, you'll find lots of supporting material, other podcasts, lots of data at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.